go. 9:06. Right on time, Ursula. I appreciate that. You're always right on time. Oh, Tom, there you are.
Wow, what a wedding. Diving in.
On a scale of 1 to 10, let's go around the room. I'm getting to you last, Tom. Ursula, 1 to 10. 10 being like, couldn't get another, couldn't, loved it, wanted to see every second of it.
I did see every second of it.
Okay.
10.
10. Andrew in the other room.
1.
Andrew right here.
What happened?
Good. Tom.
1.
1. Okay, good.
Oh, stop.
And you, John.
1. How about you? 1. Barely a 1. Barely a 1. Oh, Ursa, please. Please.
Oh, John, please.
Oh, please yourself.
Yeah. Why was it a 1?
What do you think? Who cares? Really, who cares?
A lot of people.
Her dress. Oh, look at these. Oh, look what he's wearing.
No. You haven't been clued in.
God.
You haven't been clued in. History was made.
Oh, okay. All right. Well, why is Tom at a 1? Don't give me a hard time. Why are you sitting
at the
top?
He didn't even watch. He was so busy with Sif.
Okay, yeah, that's right. You know me too well.
Yes.
This is a 3-page rundown of our show, and not once did we mention it in the pre-show meeting, Ursula. Tom, you brought it up.
I know.
Wow. All right, to the news. Here we go. Scary story. So it's up near Snoqualmie. This is near North Bend. A great place to go mountain biking. There's trails to there. I do hiking there all the time. And two guys are out, and they're hiking along, or they're mountain biking along, and I guess one of them turns around and sees that the cougar is behind them, right? Is that how it all begins, Tom? Because CBS News has some more of the details. We'll get around to the back part of it. Here we go.
State wildlife agents say this 100-pound cougar, a 3 to 4-year-old male, injured one man and killed another Saturday morning. The victims were mountain biking around 11 a.m. when they noticed the panther chasing them. Officials say the man stopped and did what they were supposed to do, try to scare the predator away.
One of the victims swung their bike toward the animal as it approached, and that caused it to run off into the woods.
But the reprieve was short-lived. The puma returned moments later and pounced on one of the bikers, Isaac Cederbaum.
He said he had his whole entire head in the jaws of this animal and was being shaken around horribly.
The big cat released him and then attacked his friend, S.J. Brooks. Cederbaum managed to get back on his bike and rode about 2 miles until he could get a cell phone signal to call 911. Hours later, rescuers cornered the mountain lion in a tree and killed it. They first spotted it standing on Brooks' body.
The cougar had actually drugged the victim back into the wood line, and he was found dead there.
A cougar was seen in the same area 3 weeks earlier. It's unclear if the same animal attacked the men this weekend.
The fact that it stayed in close proximity to these folks and attacked and stayed with them is highly, highly unusual.
Wow. Sounds like CBS is cutting all their voiceovers, Tom, in the men's room.
Okay. Must have been the weekend.
The reason this is making news is because it's so unbelievably rare. When was the last time someone was killed by a cougar?
Almost a century ago, 1924. Mm-hmm. So there have been something like 15 attacks. But rarely are they fatal, and again, not in a century's worth of time. And the scary thing about this, in addition to just the end result, was that they apparently did everything right initially, and the cougar, you know, sort of was scared and ran off. But in this case, they said the cougar was stalking them. When they scared it off, he then, you know, curled around and came back at them, and all this, and it's like, oh my God, it really is a pretty stunning in the details.
Yeah. Do you ever, I know we go hiking up near Cougar Mountain, and then there's another spot up near Issaquah, Squawk Mountain. And they have a sign out front that'll say bears have been sighted in this area.
Is that right?
And I remember one time we took the kids up there, and we stopped, and there's a picture of this thing, and it says bears inside this area. They're like, okay, let's go. I both turned around and went back. And it's funny because you're sort of like, okay, well, what are the chances?
Yeah.
Well, they give you fair warning. And then you say, oh, you just make noise and the bear runs away, or you make enough noise not to scare the bear.
Yeah.
As soon as I saw a sign like that, if I knew that mountain lions had been seen in that area, why bother going there? I'm not saying there probably were no signs for this one, right?
Yes.
I'm assuming. Entering the trail?
Yeah. It doesn't say that there were or weren't, so let's assume they're not.
Yeah.
And the thing is, and then Ursula just reported this too, They're doing a necropsy on the cougar because they think that this is unusual. They called him emaciated, that he was like a good 30 pounds lighter than the average cougar, and he might have just been sick, might have been kind of out of his head, because he uh, his reaction was atypical.
The cougar responded with its typical prey response. So when the one guy, Brooks, ran away from his friend was being attacked, Brooks runs away. The cougar lets go of the one guy that he's attacking and goes after Brooks. And then, so in that act of running away to save his life, he ends up losing his life and saves the other guy's life.
Yeah, I mean, that's what they say. It triggered a chase response in the cougar. It's like, what do you do, and how calculated was it? Just the background of this poor guy who died, said he had he just got his doctorate in philosophy, and he was office manager of this Gino Family Cyclery. That was one of the businesses. I live in the Greenwood area. One of the businesses that got blown to smithereens during the explosion, so I might have even, crossed his path a few times.
Here's what they say you're supposed to do if attacked by a cougar, and as rare as it is, you're supposed to curl up in a ball and cover your head and throat as best you can with your arms and hands. So you curl up so you can't get to your stomach, but really what he's trying to do is get to your neck. And once he severs that artery, that's pretty much the end of you. So you're just supposed to completely cover yourself up in a ball and just scream and yell and hope he ends up leaving you alone.
Well, initially they said, but they made, a bunch of noise and that scared him off. But if he comes back and you're about to be attacked, ball up, I guess.
Huh? All right. An anonymous woman has come forward on 60 Minutes to talk about her encounter with Mario Batali. Apparently it happened in the party room at the Spotted Pig restaurant back in 2005. So there were some rumbling that Mario has a problem and he's part of this hashtag Me Too. And he had said, I'm stepping down, I'm going to move away, and I'm going to sort of let other people run it. But he was not going to be the front man for his organization of a successful restaurant.
So there were four women that accused him of improper touching. And he stepped down from the high-profile position he had, and he apologized. So it seemed to me that he accepted something. But now we have a much more serious charge being leveled at him.
So here's the woman explaining what happened to her.
She was working in Vitaly's restaurant, Babo, when she says he invited her to the Spotted Pig for a party. She says she remembers sitting with Vitaly alone at a small table on the second floor, drinking white wine.
It gets completely foggy for me. And this is part of the messy, scary part for me. There is a part where it all disappears. I remember a moment where I was on his lap, kissing him, like he was kissing me. And then I remember throwing up in a toilet, and that is all.
She says she woke up around dawn in a room on the third floor of the building.
I woke up by myself on the floor. I don't know where I am, of an empty room, wooden floor. I see broken bottles. The first thing I think is I've been drugged. That was the first thing I thought, is I've been assaulted. My right leg was very deeply wounded, like scratched, like deep scratches. But I also did find, I looked on my skirt, there were two areas, it looked like DNA.
Semen. She says she had to go into work, and hours later was back at Batali's restaurant, Babo, when he called in.
I said, what happened?
You asked him that?
Yeah, I asked him, what happened last night? And he just was silent, wouldn't talk to me.
Okay, so she's not coming forward. She's an actress, and she's afraid it's going to affect her work if she were to come forward. So then they find out, what's happening at this Spotted Pig restaurant? He doesn't own it. Somebody else owns that one. But apparently there's a party room on the third floor, which is a big place that you can have a whole bunch of folks and have food there on the third floor of the Spotted Pig. They have cameras inside that third floor. So one night, Mario Batali's doing his sort of thing. They had a big party. There was only two people left after the party. It was Mario and this other woman. And the people that are managing the Spotted Pig, so it's late, it's like 1 or something, or 2 in the morning, something like that, they happen to be looking up at the video cameras, and they tell Anderson Cooper what they see.
We were in the third floor of the restaurant, and there are cameras, and there had been a party, and it dwindled down to two people, Mario and then this woman.
Seed says she was counting the evening's receipts in the office and watched on a video monitor as Mario Batali began to reach his hand up between the legs of the woman.
She looked like this. So that, to me, looks like someone is unconscious.
And he actually...
Her head, she demonstrated by having her head slumped forward.
So you saw him pull up his chair and start to touch her sexually.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. When you saw that on the monitor, what did you think?
You know, he crossed a line, a huge line, as of to doing assaulting someone that's unconscious. So we all went out there and we stopped what was going on. Hey, Mario, how are you doing? Let's get you a cab. Just, you know, we were saying something just to snap him out of this.
You have no doubt you saw Mario Batali.
No doubt.
Sexually assaulting an unconscious or semi-conscious woman.
Yeah, no doubt at all.
Okay. So now the police have opened an investigation against Mario.
That's right. This was a, was it 3 years later or 3 years earlier that this incident happened?
3 years later. So okay. 2005, so 3 years later, 2008.
So this is, it's pretty damning, the story. Now, he denies it. To be fair to him, he denies it flat out. Again, yeah. He apologized for the accusations of inappropriate touching with four other women in an earlier situation. But this one he adamantly denies. Yeah. This one sounds much more criminally concerning.
Yeah.
Beyond this, I don't know what more to do. But if they have witnesses to something that he did later in the same place, clearly there's a pattern developing, and
yeah.
It's going to be tough for him to defend unless he has.
I think it'd be interesting to ask the woman. So in 2005, when she said that she was drugged and assaulted, she believes by Mario, she went down and got a rape test done by at the hospital. But then, because she doesn't charge him and doesn't file with the police, the kit is never tested and it's disposed of. So you think now? So here it is in light of 2018. If you would have known that you could have had the support and that you could take down someone like this by coming forward. And she would have been one of the first to come out and be able to say, here it is, test, DNA. They would go get it from him. And then in 2005, she would have stopped other women possibly from being raped by, if it is a rape,
yes,
from the famous chef.
That's the tricky thing that you have to, if you're a victim of a crime, if you're a rape victim, you have to balance How is it going to help you personally versus your sort of social responsibility
yes.
to all other future possible victims? And we've heard from a lot of people who said, "Oh, I should have spoken up. I feel guilty now because
I wonder if that weighs on
spoken
her.
Up." Yeah, I would guess so.
Let's see, Seattle City Council, see if it weighs on them. They're voting on a tax for downtown property owners. It's known as a LID. Basically, it works this way. If the city is going to spend a bunch of money to improve property around your property and it's going to have a benefit to your property in that the value of your property increases, then, hey, you should pay a little of something for that. That's the idea of the LID. So we're going to improve this area. You're going to benefit. Everybody else is going to benefit as well. They're all going to pour in from all over the place to come down and beautiful walk around the beautiful waterfront. But you'll be able to sell your condo for that much more because we've improved your view.
Most of the people that are paying this proposed tax, and by the way, this is very preliminary. Today is going to be the first time where the council even considers whether they should consider it.
But they've been thinking about this since 2012.
No, but okay, so I don't know that they've been talking about improving the waterfront, so it's getting closer. But the idea is that there's not going to be any vote at this point to pass this. This is not going to come to a head. If they can decide to consider it today, then they're going to again. There's going to be an all summer thing where they take public comment before a final vote's scheduled to September. But but putting that all aside, let's just deal with the issue itself. Most of the people that will be paying these taxes are commercial property owners, but there are individuals who also live along there.
Yeah.
And that's for them. That's the question. Is this going to really benefit us individually? I suppose if you sell your condo. But I do think most people probably acknowledge that commercial property owners on a gorgeous waterfront, mm-hmm. people who have a business there will probably benefit from it.
Right. But so the property owners that have the commercial will pass it on to the tenants. Then the tenants will be forced to determine whether or not they can do enough business with the increased cost. So as and you can pay it, I think they give you a 20-year period that you can pay it. You pay they're not calling it a tax, whatever it is, pay the money, plus you also pay interest on it. So the commercial property owners would slowly begin to increase the price of the rent, and then the retailer that renting in that space would have to determine, will I get enough business from the new people that are coming down to the waterfront to support the increased rent? So it's just going to be a pass along to probably those that are down there that are smaller businesses that maybe don't have the margins to be able to support a new tax. So we'll see them get flushed out, and then maybe somebody else that can afford the higher rent would be able to move in there. That's the way it works.
I don't know. I mean, the thing is that if it's true, it's probably going to get – the waterfront is going to be more expensive for all of us. Any of us who, you know, you buy an ice cream cone on the waterfront after a gorgeous remodel where it's, you know, it's a valued place, will probably pay more, yes.
So here's an argument against this thing. Somebody said, well, how about this? How about if the city says, hey, you know, the Woodland Park Zoo needs a new parking garage. So let's assess all the property around there within like a 6-block area or a 10-block area. All the homes in that area will get an additional tax put upon their property because we're going to improve Woodland Park Zoo, which will improve the overall experience for people that happen to live near Woodland Park Zoo.
I don't think it's a parallel, and just because of the waterfront and the zoo attracts a different kind of a clientele. However, that was proposed, remember? Yep. And people in the neighborhood objected to, they were going to do it on their own and not even tax them. They didn't even want the parking structure to be built, and so it wasn't.
I think with the way the city's being run, and it seems to be in such an irresponsible manner with people's money, that a few of the people that own condos are like, look, I don't want to give I could give $10,000 to the city, but I don't want to give $10,000. They're asking for more transparency. So we'll see. So what's going to happen today? Is it today they make the decision to move forward on it?
Well, yeah. Today they look for, they officially approve to consider it.
Uh-huh.
And then it's going to be a 5-month, decision, and they'll take a lot of public comment. There'll be public hearings, and then they'll eventually vote on it September, up or down.
Starbucks has released a new policy, so now you can sleep in Starbucks now. You can sleep in Starbucks. You don't have
That's not how they're advertising it, John.
Well, Tom, you don't have to buy anything.
Yeah, that's true.
And as long as you're not an annoyance, you can sleep in Starbucks.
I assume that you have to sleep sitting up.
You can't lay down?
I don't think you can lay down. Hmm. But still, so what you're raising is some of the possibilities. This seems like a smart move on their part to balance the bad PR they got from the arrest of those two guys in Philadelphia. Uh-huh. I'm just wondering if there's going to be any kind of consequences. In other words, they said, oh, okay, we're just going to let everybody in if people are going to start camping out at Starbucks that they don't already do, if this is going to encourage more more uses. I mean, a lot of bars, a lot of establishments, restaurants, restrooms are only for patrons.
Mm-hmm.
That's not going to, be able to fly as easily if you allow anybody in.
Right. Well, it makes it easier for the managers. The policy is just across the board. You don't have to use any sort of discernment on your part. We're not going to ask you to step up and determine the person. Here's the only place to be is they're going to have to probably have 6 pages on this. What is an annoyance? Because they can ask you to leave if you're annoying. Can your smell be annoying?
Well, what I read was it's considered safety. It's a public safety issue. You can have them. So yes, would smell be? Because I didn't read the I didn't see anything about annoyance. But yeah, I would. That's a good question. Yeah. Okay. So
if somebody complains about you being really stinky, you wearing too much cologne, and they want you to leave.
Cologne, yeah, that's usually the problem. Too much cologne.
What are you looking at me for? Stop it. Enjoy my stink. We'll be right back.
Sweet smell of success.
Heal Mortgage. Over the weekend, you're out there looking around. You see your neighbor's got his house on the market. You pull that sheet out, and you're like, wow, look how much they're asking for. I'm going to go maybe sell the house. Maybe you want to take some money out of yours. Always get in touch with Keel Mortgage, 1-888-778-KIEL, Keel Mortgage, CL53969. You can write to us at MyNorthwest.com. You can text as well at 98973. I do love hearing from you. Please realize that one of you, whether you like it or not, is going to become letter of the day. They all pour in. Andrew reads through them. I don't know if anybody's ever, I don't want to be letter of the day. I don't want my word to be the final word of the show. I'm not good enough. Yes, you are. Yes, you are. We'll see who it is. Becomes the letter of the day. This is also an opportunity for you to test out how quickly you can text, because we're going to talk about gun control. And nothing gets people texting radio shows more than gun control or abortion. So we thought we'd hit this one. Here we go. So after the shooting in outside of Houston, Texas, the response has been quick. And, of course, everybody takes their sides. Lieutenant Governor Dan Patrick says the incident shows the need.
From Texas.
Yeah, he's from Texas. He says, let's arm some teachers.
We cannot have soft targets. Anyone with a gun needs to know there are teachers in there that are trained and armed, and there's law enforcement in there, and I'm not going to make it past the door.
All right. So we have we're going to yield the field to the fact that we have mentally ill people wanting to kill a bunch of people. And what we're going to do is we're going to
mentally ill people with access to guns.
Right, mentally ill people. Or they could have access to bombs or knives like they have in London. So it's mentally ill people. So we're not going to address the fact that these people seem to have a problem with their life and other people's lives and the value of those lives. Let's have armed teachers, or let's have make sure we get the doors reinforced, have a single entry, all sorts of different things. We don't really truly want to address the real problem. Here's from Oliver North. He's the National Rifle Association, the future president, I might add, Tom.
There was no way to detect a firearm being brought into the building. Yeah. Look, you and I came through the lobby here in this building where we're sitting right now. There was a security desk there. There was a barrier for us to pass through. You can't get on an airplane today without going through a metal detector.
Okay, so metal detectors in schools, they do exist in Chicago. They're in Washington, D.C., in Detroit, some in Baltimore as well. They've got metal detectors.
That was funny because we cut that off because Chris Wallace was interviewing him. He says, wait a minute, we don't have metal detectors here at Fox News. We have a desk where you can easily walk by. So, but still, yeah, I mean, do we want these schools to be more like prisons and or, courtrooms or courthouses and have them, heavily manned? It would cost a fortune and it may not be effective. But right now, one of the problems they say is that, yeah, if you limit the number of entrances so you can screen who comes in, you maximize the number of problems if somebody does get through, because then they don't have exits.
Yes.
You know, that's true of all the high schools or all the schools. You have multiple exits and entrances, and that's a good thing when you're trying to get away, and it's a bad thing when you're trying to restrict people from getting in.
I'm going to bring something new to the conversation. Malcolm Gladwell, you a fan of some of the work that he does?
Some of the work. You know, he's very catchy. He's a great writer.
Yes.
I have heard there's been, after a big push, I have heard that a lot of his stuff is sexier than it is authentic.
Okay. Here is his theory on these school shootings. It was the Columbine shooting of, was it 1989,
I thought, wasn't it?
Was it 87 or something? 89. Oh. That was the beginning. He says it's very similar to the riot theory, which is this. The first guy that goes out into the street and picks up a rock and throws it a window, he's at a zero as far as his concern for what could happen to him. The next person standing next to him who doesn't have a rock is at a one, okay? So what happens is the first guy is just like, and throws the rock. Second guy is then influenced by the behavior of the first guy. He picks up a rock because the one guy was at a zero. The second guy is at a one as far as, like, tolerance, right?
Well, no, wait a minute. In terms of pushback?
No. It's that the one guy's so angry.
Yeah, that he breaks
the window.
Consequences?
Right. It's all anger.
It's
right?
All rage.
All rage. Okay. Ram, bam. The second guy standing next to him is like, geez, look at that. You know what? Okay. And then he throws the rock. And then what happens is according to Gladwell, and this is not his work, this is a scientist's work, that as it goes down the line, you're reducing the amount of rage you need in order to throw the rock. So here's the most chilling part of the final conclusion of that. Let's not kid ourselves that we've passed the strictest gun control in the world, that it would end this particular type of behavior. Here's the best part. It's that young people no longer need to be deeply disturbed to contemplate horrific acts. So if you take the rock-throwing theory, it's becoming less and less of the incredibly angry kids. And then it's much harder to go in there and say, well, look, they showed all the signs. Harris and Klebold wanted to kill 600 people within 1 second. They put the propane bombs all around the cafeteria. Then they were going to position themselves outside and shoot people as they're coming out. The third part of the plan was their car was supposed to be filled with explosives that was parked near the school buses and where the police were and where the cameras were. They wanted to kill thousands and thousands and thousands of people live on television. That was their plan. They wanted to have the most horrific act that the rest of the world would talk about for the rest of humanity. That's how they wanted to be known as. So they were the worst of the worst. And then now what's happened is you get less and less. You don't need to be as angry as those two in order to be able to go into a school and shoot and kill people. How about that?
Well, on
the riot idea, the idea the first guy throws the rock, it becomes less and less intense. You don't need to be so angry.
Yeah, see, I think that flies in the face of a lot of incidents where, for instance, that guy that, you know, shot the guy who was mad at women, part of the incel. He's the hero of the incel movement.
Mowing
now.
Them down in the streets of New York.
The guy that was in California. Oh, that, no, the guy, the individual who, he said, hey, women, just screw you,
on
I'm
video,
gonna get back
right,
to you,
yeah,
and I'm
yeah.
going to, yeah, and he did the video thing.
Yeah.
That he seemed as angry as anybody, and they're now using, a lot of these school shooters are using the Columbine people as some kind of models, role models and heroes, and they want to up the ante. Okay, if they killed 50, I want to kill 60. Mm-hmm. They killed 60, I want to kill 70. I don't know that it's a kind of a lessening of anger. It feels to me like a lot of the people are just as angry. I don't know. I mean, I'm sort of processing what you just threw at me. I just don't know if that rings true until this case.
Yeah.
This is an interesting case because unlike the other red flags for the Parkland guy and for other instances, even locally, where they actually talk to a guy and then they have to let him go, even mm-hmm. though he's seen all these signs and he's threatened, this guy seemed relatively well-adjusted. I mean, he was on the football team. He seemed like a
nice guy.
He quit
the football team, and then he walked around in a trench coat, and he posted things. And he had a T-shirt that said natural killer. He had some indicators that he was not loved by people, and he might have had some problems.
Well, no, I mean, in retrospect, he clearly must have had problems with it. He wore a trench coat, but he wore a trench coat all the time, so that was not seen as any kind of a indicator of, now, I don't know.
Okay, then this proves my point. So he was not a crazy guy,
that's what I'm saying.
So he's not some crazy lunatic like that one guy who police had been called 70 sometimes to the house.
Yes.
This is a sort of a low simmering sense of grievance against people.
My point is, I think most of the cases that we've looked at have been red flags, and the guy's clearly, something is off, and the police have come to the Parkland shooting. They went to his house a lot of times. This is, though, in this case that we're looking at now in Santa Fe, Texas, this does seem to be a guy who's sort of on a low simmer, mm-hmm. and maybe his outrage isn't as high as others, and because of that, he just thought, oh, there's an option. My concern is, like, this copycat idea. It gives you an idea. They say that one of the dangers of a suicide in a family is it seems to give suicide to all the other members of the family. Like, oh, that's an option.
See, that's
whereas
right.
others wouldn't even consider it. Now we've had school shooters go, well, I'm angry. My girlfriend dumped me, or I got a D in my class.
Exactly.
Then maybe that's all it takes.
You go.
That's right. But I think this is a rare case where that might seem to be the tipping point.
Well, they're coming more often. Right now we're getting one, I think, every 2 or 3 months. And
16 since the beginning of the year, according to Fox.
So then the question is that as you see more of it, it becomes more common, and then you start just like the same theory of the suicide, Tom.
Yes.
So the kid is sitting there, and he watches the one kid go into the school, and he shoot everybody up, and he's like, well, look at that. You know what? I'm pretty mad, too.
Yeah.
And then you see video of him, and then you get attention, and then people would know how mad you are. Harris and Klebold were in a class by themselves as far as what their plan was. 4 years after the shooting, the FBI and the top criminologist all met outside this place in Virginia, and they worked on all the details, and they went through the journal and everything else, and that's where they came up with this master plan that these two guys had to kill as many people as they could possibly kill on American soil that was non-military.
And even with those two, though, it was clearly much more Eric Harris's idea. Dylan Klebold just sort of went along with it.
Right. Harris, they say, was a sociopath. Right. The other guy just sort of went along. But, yeah, they had bombs. They said they would have killed 600 people in that cafeteria if they had done a better job connecting the propane tanks. We'll come right back. It's the Tom and Curley Show right here on Cairo Radio. Concerned about Ursula.
How so?
Like that her rug has gunk on it. I mean, that is, what is going on in that household?
I
know she's got two rambunctious boys and a dog with some type of digestive problem, but gunk. Gunk on the rug.
It's not supposed to be allowed in her neighborhood.
It's gunk.
She admits to all sorts of problems.
She's no filter. All right.
Working on him. She's getting them all fixed.
You can write to us at mynorthwest.com. You can text as well at 98973. We'll talk about gunk on rugs later on at top 10 o'clock, by the way. Tune in for that. LeBron James, it's over for the Cleveland Cavaliers. And now the question is, will he stay in Cleveland? Will he go somewhere else? Can they trade him?
It's over.
Tom, really?
It's 2-1.
They're coming back?
Yeah, they could.
No, they're done.
Okay.
I love LeBron James.
Yes,
I think
you do.
He is superhuman. He comes down from heaven. And he is the god of all basketball players. All right?
Especially
be nice
now.
If he had some teammates.
Yes, that's
okay.
Right.
But when the playoffs began, he wanted to focus primarily on the playoffs. He doesn't want to get into a thing where he's reading his Instagram and people tweeting back and forth and taking him to task and stuff, because he is a little bit of a hothead at times. Okay. So he decides he's going to do something interesting with his Instagram as the playoffs begin. What does he do, Tom?
He turns it over to somebody else.
Yes.
I think it's a great idea. He decided now it's with the LeBron James Foundation. I mean, there are a lot of, you know, corporate components to this. But basically he says, listen, there's not enough good news in the world today. I'm going to turn over my Instagram. And I forget now how many millions of people that follow him, mm-hmm. to people that have good stories or, you know, things that they're doing good to change the world. And yes. So he's got 14 now that have been posted. As long as he stays, the longer he stays in the playoffs, this is a reason why you might want to be rooting for
underdog. Do well.
Okay. As long as he's in the playoffs, he's allowing for all these kids to tell their story. And one that's highlighted is this guy named Jalen Arnold.
Mm-hmm.
He's on his Instagram in the first week. He's called something called Jalen's Challenge. His cause is to eliminate bullying.
Okay.
He has himself, and you can see why this is a case close to his heart. He has Tourette's syndrome, Asperger's syndrome, and obsessive compulsive disorder. So he was bullied a lot when he was younger.
Here he is.
Oh, we actually have sound?
Yeah.
Beautiful.
Jalen Arnold had these sixth graders captivated, using only a sheet of paper to tell the story of how he felt when he was bullied.
And this is when you call that person stupid or call that person ugly, and you keep bullying them every day. This is what that person is reduced down to. They feel like trash.
He says even when it's over.
You guys see this piece of paper now? It still has scars on it from the words and the horrible bullying.
How about that? How about Jakil Jackson? Also one that got to take over the Instagram. This is an 8-year-old Chicago boy created blessing bags full of toiletries made for the homeless.
Stuff that's in the blessing bags are tissue, soap, water, deodorant, usually stuff that can help them in their everyday activities. And after we get the bags ready, we put all the bags in a huge bag. We separate them by men and lady, and then we put them in my godfather's truck, and then we pass them out from my godfather's truck.
So does it say how much response these kids get now? Because he's turning over how many people follow him on Instagram. It must be millions and millions of people follow him. So he's basically saying, here's my platform. Now learn about kids that are doing great things.
Yes. I don't think that this is a relatively new, and so I don't know if we can look back and see in, say, a month or two if all of these 14 stories and counting have been posted. But it's just an example of him doing something for the greater good.
Yes.
LeBron James.
Now, if he can get some support. Tom, greatest basketball player in the last 100 years?
Well, everyone still says Michael Jordan, but LeBron James is a close second. How's that?
I like him. We'll be right back. Tom and Curly right here on Cairo Radio.